We're talking about the Last Mile Challenge on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Our transit networks, they still have a long way to go to create equitable transportation. And commuters in large and small communities alike have trouble reaching their destination, even if the bus stop is in the vicinity. But rideshare providers may be able to help workers bridge that last mile gap. And Milwaukee is testing out a pilot program called FlexRide. Would you use a rideshare service if it were affordable and convenient? Do you have trouble getting to places that your bus doesn't go? Do you walk along the edge of roads to get to the door of where you need to be? 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Lingxin Hu is a professor at the UW-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning, where she chairs the Urban Planning Department. Lingxin Hu, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Can you briefly give us a sense of the transportation challenges in Milwaukee as people get around? What are you up against in urban planning in the area of transportation?
We talk about transportation equity because it provides access for people to reach jobs. That's the focus for our project here, but also access to education, access to healthy food, access to healthcare, which is essential nowadays. So in urban planning field, we're talking about providing transportation service that connect people in certain neighborhoods where they don't have cars, when they don't have efficient transportation services, including transit, to help them reaching out to opportunities in the suburban areas. So that's the goal of this project. It fills a transportation gap, which we know is a long-term problem in our region. It fills the transportation gap and connect people with suburban neighborhoods, and we provide the flexible, affordable transportation services across the county boundary into Waukesha in this case.
And that's the thing too, is because there's a suburb sprawl. There are businesses going out and out and into outer burbs as well. And so that becomes more and more difficult to connect people inside Milwaukee with all of the things that they're trying to get to farther and farther out.
That's exactly true. And jobs are spreading out, healthcare, schools, everything is spreading out. But the flip side of it is like a lot of people are constrained in their housing location. So we face segregation problem in our region. And a lot of people do not have many opportunities to move out to the suburbs. And they are constrained in our city neighborhoods. And then our city neighborhoods are losing the job opportunities, the healthy grocery stores, etc. So segregation is the flip side of it. It's another problem in our region, unfortunately. So when opportunities are moving out, people are constrained in the inner city. We have to provide the transportation services to connect those people with opportunities which are moving further out. And
So within that problem that we see there, connected to this FlexRide approach, what did you develop in FlexRide?
FlexRide can, in our scope, can solve two problems. One problem is that it's a transportation problem, and we don't have the regional transit agencies that cover cross-county boundary transit services for the whole region. And that's the reason our transit services are county by county. Mm. And FlexRide can solve those problems and connecting people across the county boundary. That's one part of it. And the second part of it is actually we're testing a planning process which involves the actual users of FlexRide. And we want to see if this bottom up, if we really focus on the users, can we provide efficient transportation services for them? And if we prove this successful, we probably can use the pilot, and we hope we can use the pilot to apply for permanent funding that sustained FlexRide Milwaukee and expanded for our whole region. So the other part of it is a experiment, and it's to see whether we can solve an institutional barrier for our region.
Well, walk us through a hypothetical user and how they would use FlexRide. What would that ride entail? How would they use it? What would happen?
I want to walk one step back, because this is a research project. Mm-hmm. So we have a screening process, and the screening process is that the service is available for residents who live in the city of Milwaukee and are currently working or waiting to work in Menominee Falls, Butler area.
And they Menominee have to be Falls and Butler, which are two villages.
Right, exactly. So the employment zones in the two villages.
Okay.
So after the screening process, we will give access for all those eligible participants to use our service. And our service is on demand. It's like Uber Lyft, but you request the service from the 5 predetermined stops. And I will just use 1 minute to mention the 5 stops. So closer to the county boundary, that's Woodsman's and Sam's Club, and Lover's Lane at Silver Spring Road. So those are the 2 last stops for some MCTS buses, mm-hmm, before they reach the county boundary. And those are the 2 stops on the county boundary. And there are 3 stops closer to the city. So it's Silver Spring Neighborhood Center, Midtown, and Sherman Phoenix. You can request service from the 5 stops. It's like Uber Lyft. You open the app, and we have a 414 number for those people who do not have smartphones. So you can open the app or you call the operators. You let them know where you are in the 5 stops, and you let them know your destination, which are anywhere, any businesses in the 2 employment zones in Butler and Menominee Falls. And the app or the phone operator will let you know the pick up time, the vehicles, who's going to pick you up, and some information about the driver and the license plate number. It's like what you see on Uber Lyft. Can I just quickly add, you can also request wheelchair accessible vehicles, because some workers need that. So that's the service we provide.
Well, let me just reintroduce you a moment here. Ling Shenhu chairs the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning as we discuss transportation challenges in the city and that last mile issue and explaining a new FlexRide pilot program. You can join in 800-642-1234 and see maybe how it could work in your community. Let's go to Marshall in Madison. Hi, Marshall.
Hey there. Hi. So I used to work at a company in Madison that would provide those rides early on in the mornings. And individuals who were in that position where they lived so far away from where they worked, even locally around in the Madison area. And what we found were, as the company that bridged that gap, that a lot of those rides are so early in the morning. We're talking that they might get off work at 2:30, 3:30 in the morning, and they might be going in at other shifts, might be going in at like 4:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of the transportation is not when buses are readily available to ship people out and bring them back. And also, not to mention that they're going to the places where the buses are not going to commonly be going. So mm-hmm. The problem that we had was in people who would either schedule an appointment and then not show up, or if we were picking them up from work, they'd have to work an extra 15, 20 minutes. And at 4:30 in the morning, we are getting into the busiest possible time getting everyone to the airport. So we couldn't hang around, and it would really mess a lot of people up trying to get them home.
You bring up such great, interesting, complex issues, Marshall. Ling Shenhu, go ahead.
Yes, that's exactly one of the challenges that we face, Marshall. And I need to say that our service is available for 16 hours a day. So it's from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. on weekdays. And we spend a lot of time talking about different shifting time. Well, I have to say that although we have $1 million grant, it's really not enough. It doesn't cover like the 24/7 that we want to cover. So we hope that when we test pilot the project, when we have some results, and the permanent funding can really cover all time shifts for the employees who need the service.
How many users can be in your test pilot program?
We don't have a fixed number. It really depends on, as Marshall was saying, like during peak hours, there is going to be a lot of demand, so a lot of vehicles, but off peak hours, probably the demand can be tapered down. So we don't have a fixed number, but a realistic estimate is 100 to 150 participants.
We have UW-Milwaukee Urban Planning Department Chair Ling Xinhu, who is working on ways to improve regional transportation, helping people get to where they really need to go at the time they need to get there. How is your community, your company, dealing with the last mile challenge in public transit? Would you use a rideshare service if it were less costly, more convenient? What does your commute entail? How has it changed in these times? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the vexing disparities in transportation, how to address the last mile challenge of getting people to exactly where they need to be. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. According to the Census Bureau's American Community Survey that was published in 2019, more than 17% of Milwaukee residents do not have a vehicle available to them. Ling Xinhu is in UW-Milwaukee's Urban Planning Department, leads the department, and is with us for about five more minutes. Let's bring on another caller, Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, this is very interesting. You know, somebody has suggested that it's the smartphone, for those of us who have them, is actually going to be the new mobility device. And it sounds like what they're doing in the Milwaukee area is operating in real time. People request the trips as they're needed, and perhaps they can draw on not only just the rideshare program, but other modes as well. But I did hear about a program in Sheboygan that I thought was interesting. Now, I don't know if it can be scaled up for any other community, but what they do is they it's kind of like a shared ride taxi, and they pick up people reserve the trips a day in advance. Mm. And what they do is they can, you know, they congregate the trips and assign the routes to the drivers on the following day. Hmm. And so it's really, you know, it's very flexible, and it adapts to the trips as they're needed on any particular day. And I just thought that was interesting.
Lisa, thank you for bringing that. Professor Hu, have you looked into that model that Lisa brought up about Sheboygan?
I am imagining, I don't know if it's true or not, the project that Lisa is talking about is also operated by VIA, which is also the service provider for us. It sounds like they provide slightly different services in Sheboygan. And I want to say that for most of our regions in Wisconsin, we face the challenge of the lack of transit services. And that's the reason there are other new type of paratransit, which is Lisa talking about, and a microtransit, which is our project. So like different formats, different modes of transit that try to fill in the gaps. And I'm hoping that either transit agencies or some other regional agencies would pick up this pilot paratransit or microtransit eventually down the road and develop public-private partnership to sustain all those flexible, customized transit services for their region.
So as you roll out this pilot program and evaluate it, I'm wondering, what does the evaluation look like as to whether this is a solution? What does success look like in microtransit?
Our pilot will run for about 9 months. So we just entered our first phase. During the second phase, we will change the fare so that the fare could be a realistic long-term fare for similar services down the road. So at the end of the 9 months, we will do a surveys of the riders and the business owners in our business area, Menominee Falls, Butler areas, and we'll let them know, we'll ask them how they evaluate. Do they retain more jobs? Do they increase the wage rates? How's their satisfaction with their commutes? Does that help with their productivity? And we might want to ask if people shift their travel mode from driving alone to using a micro transit services that can serve, help with our climate. So that's the quantitative side of it. And on the qualitative research side of it, we will also interview, we'll also talk with our partners. And our partners include a lot of labor force organization, business organization, and ask them how's their evaluation about our performance in terms of promoting economic development, solving the labor shortage problem in our region.
Lots of research to come. Professor Hu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Lingxin Hu is chair of the department and professor at UW-Milwaukee School of Architecture and Urban Planning. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about one boy's surprise visit from a local Olympic gold medalist.
There's something kind of magical about watching the Olympics. The competition, the diversity, the sportsmanship, and camaraderie. 4 years ago, a boy from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, fell in love with curling. And recently, a knock on his door has him even more excited for the games in Beijing.
I'm Eric Ernst.
And I am Jackson Ernst.
Jackson was 5 years old when he discovered curling during the 2018 Winter Olympics.
Well, when I was younger, we were watching the Olympics, and the only thing that I didn't want to turn on any other Olympic theme rather than curling. And I kept watching it, and I kept replaying it over and over and over again.
Yeah, Jackson's been a hockey player since he was very little, but he was really intrigued by another sport on the ice like that.
McFarland, Wisconsin's Matt Hamilton won a gold medal in curling that year as part of Team USA in the men's competition.
Well, I'm Matt Hamilton, second for Team Schuster and 2022 Olympian.
So recently when Matt...
Here, hold on, I got one more shot to throw.
Yeah, so I caught up with Matt at curling practice recently.
All right, what's going on?
All right, so Matt saw a social media post from Jackson's dad about his son's curling obsession back during the 2018 Olympics.
After watching us win, that they went to like Kohl's or something, and he used like whatever money he got for Christmas or something, or his birthday or something, to buy like a cleaning set so he could get a broom. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, that's amazing. Any broom will do, apparently.
Yeah, I used a ball and I basically just rolled it, and then I got my broom and I kind of just sweeped.
And he did. He spent the rest of the Olympics every time curling was on, just, you know, sweeping around the house.
So when Hamilton saw Jackson's story on Twitter,
Matt shared it with his followers, and then he sent us a message and said, can you share your address? I'd love to send Jackson a gift. And so I did, and I didn't think anything of it.
And then I found out he's just in Sun Prairie. So I was like, I've got the time. Like, I'll just put on a KN95 mask, and I'll go visit him and drop him off.
I had to do a double take because there's Matt Hamilton standing on our front porch. And so I quick raced to the door, and I said, Matt, oh my gosh.
And he was like, hey, Jackson's actually out back playing hockey right now.
And he said, he has a rink in the backyard. And so he was super excited about that.
It's like, perfect. I'm pretty comfortable on an ice rink. So let's go.
Yeah, Jackson has his own ice rink in the backyard.
So how that started is my dad had kind of like hockey friends, and like they were all saying how they built ice rinks. And he was like, okay, I'll give it a whirl.
I wish I had something like that as a kid. I grew up on a hill, so I had a prime sledding location. All the kids came to my house to go sledding, but never had a hockey rink.
So what did Jackson think about gold medalist Matt Hamilton standing right there in front of him?
I was like, okay, so Matt Hamilton comes to our house, he says hi, and then just leaves. And then I'm so shocked because I look in the bag and there's all the stuff that he used for the trials.
The gift bag included an autographed hat.
One of my old Team Schuster hats that I literally washed all the sweat stains off of to give to him. It was literally game used, probably an entire season worn.
And he brought his official curling glove that he signed that he used in the trials also. And he got a pin.
And a bag tag.
Yeah, a bag tag. On the front it says USA, but on the back it says Matt Hamilton.
He was really excited and pumped to show me some hockey moves that he was doing, so it was fun.
I can teach him how to be a hockey player, and he can teach me how to play curling.
As Hamilton heads to another Olympics, Jackson will be rooting for his new friend Matt.
Just being like a good role model for kids like Jackson and a good representative for Wisconsin is super important for me.
Thanks to Jackson, his dad Eric, and thanks to Olympic gold medalist Matt Hamilton.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And ahead this hour, we talk with another candidate running to be Milwaukee's next mayor. We also hear from a social epidemiologist about the grief young children go through with the loss of a parent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A study published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics estimates more than 40,000 children in the U.S. lost a parent in year one of the pandemic. Rachel Kidman is a social epidemiologist at Stony Brook University studying bereavement in children and young adults. She spoke with WPR's Lee Rayburn about how losing a parent may affect children long term.
Rachel, beyond the emotional pain, the visceral reaction, losing a parent has tangible effects. What happens when kids are left without a guardian?
You know, they're more likely to suffer from depression. They're more likely to drop out of school or otherwise have poor educational outcomes. They exhibit greater suicidality. And that rises and stays high for 25 years after a parent's death. You know, we know that it also leads to other kinds of vulnerabilities. Children who lost both parents in one study that we did were 50% more likely to then experience sexual abuse. So it's easy to see how you can draw a line from these experiences to really having challenges across the life course, you know, from dropping out of high school to poor lifetime earnings. But these experiences also raise the likelihood of really serious health problems across adulthood as well. So it's a really powerful adverse experience to lose a parent.
And when you apply that to the pandemic that we're facing today, what do you see in terms of disparities? What is we heard we're all in this together, but when we look at the data, is that what it says?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we're all facing this immense challenge, but what has become apparent throughout the pandemic is that the burden of mortality is absolutely not shared equally. There are really strong racial and economic disparities. And I think, you know, it's not surprising then that we found and other researchers have found that orphanhood is also disproportionately experienced by children of color. In our study last year, we found that Black children accounted for about 20% of those who lost a parent to COVID, but they only account for about 14% of kids in America. So I think it's really concerning. And I think it's also concerning when we start to look at what supports might be available and how those are distributed. You know, we know, for example, children in Black families are a lot less likely to receive survivor benefits within the Social Security program. And those whose parents were born outside the U.S. are even less likely. So we need to start thinking about not only who's affected, but how we're going to restructure programs to ensure that all kids have equal access to the help that they really need.
So, Rachel, what are some of the consequences that you see then in the long term of this loss?
Well, I think we need to be concerned about their mental health. We need to be concerned about their education. I think there are real concerns going forward. What happens in the immediate aftermath of a parent's death is really only the beginning.
So it's not the immediate, the need is there for the immediate bereavement, the immediate grief, but also beyond that as well.
Absolutely. You know, in the immediate aftermath, you know, there may be a need for, you know, some interventions to help children with their grief. And there's some brief evidence-based interventions that could be scaled up to really help kids with that grief. We can work with school counselors to reach a lot of these children, perhaps. But, you know, it goes beyond what they need just in the days and weeks after a parent's loss. They really need support going forward. And the best people, place to offer that support are going to be their family members. I mean, I think that's a major lesson that came through when we studied the responses in the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And that is, you know, supporting bereaved children means strengthening their family's ability to care for them. So that means strengthening the family's economic capacity to care for them and also delivering complementary interventions that improve the quality of caregiving.
Rachel Kidman is a social epidemiologist, and we're talking about how children are affected by losing parents and other caregivers to COVID-19 here on the Ideas Network. So considering the needs of these children short and long term, and going back to the disparities that we've seen in this pandemic, how should this inequity inform what we do to support kids in this moment?
Well, I think we need to think about this more holistically. A lot of what these children need are relevant to all children who are really struggling. It's a safety net for all kids. So I talked about economic support, so interventions in the US that are offering things like expanded child tax credit will raise families out of dire poverty. And that includes families who have lost a parent. I think also, you know, when we talk about making sure there's a stable, supportive caregiver for these kids, that's so key to their resiliency. We should also be talking about having positive parenting programs available. We should be talking about having bereavement leave available so that the surviving parent can take time off and really help that child in their moment of need. We should talk about family leave. And so these are very much universal supports that would benefit all kids, not just kids who are orphaned, but they would also disproportionately, hopefully, benefit kids who are really vulnerable.
Rachel, do you think it's the same for kids and adults, or are these universal supports you speak of more effective for certain ages?
I think the social supports I'm referring to are really centered around kids. They are designed for the family because the family is best able to help an individual child. I think we have to really work through extended families and make sure that they are strong because they are able to understand their children's needs the best. And so when we talk about economic supports to families, that will benefit, obviously, everybody in the family, but it's so key to a child's nutrition, it's so key to their schooling that it really has to be prioritized for children's welfare. And I think when we talk about counseling, certainly that's something that a lot of Americans need right now, not just children. But I think that it's paramount that kids who are grappling with grief and with other anxiety related to the pandemic have access to adequate psychological services.
And as I think of it, Rachel, it's not just the children who have lost guardians, it's the friends of those children that have lost guardians that are having to deal with this as well. And so it's, to some degree, all of the children and the universal supports that you mentioned. Are we paying enough attention to kids coping with all this?
I don't think so. I do think that folks have thought about how children are affected by the pandemic. It's really hard to escape. Everybody has children in their families, in their neighborhoods. And I think that folks are starting to realize how much this has posed a challenge to their mental health. I think people have been concerned about their education, but I don't think people realized how much children were grieving for parents. There have been anecdotal stories in the news, certainly, but I think the scale of the crisis has really been lost. You know, I think there tends to be a focus on mortality among the elderly, And folks don't realize how many people in their 30s and 40s and 50s are dying of COVID. And those are people in their parenting years. And so bringing those numbers to the fore, I think, is important. You know, our numbers went through February of last year. We have had far more deaths in 2021 than we did in 2020. More deaths since the vaccine became available, unfortunately. And these deaths are skewing younger, which means more parents are dying. There have been some updates. Another research group led by Susan Hillis at the CDC released a paper this summer with their own estimates, and they have been updating those estimates in real time. And they now estimate that 3.4 million children worldwide have lost at least one parent due to COVID. So I think, you know, those anecdotal stories are really important to personalize this issue. But I want people to realize that behind those are 3.4 million children with similar experiences.
What if we don't apply the universal supports that are needed for this these children? As a social epidemiologist, if we do nothing, what is our outcome?
You know, if we do nothing, we are talking about having children who are more likely to drop out of school, be depressed, commit suicide, be sexually abused. You know, if we don't change something, then those children are facing a real uphill battle. And we have a choice to make right now about investing in mental health care for children, investing in strengthening families' economic position, investing in parenting. And I think if we don't, it won't be one obvious hit. But it'll be a lot of children who are going to struggle across their life course more than they need to.
Rachel Kidman, thank you for sharing your work with us today.
And thank you for having me.
That was Stony Brook University social epidemiologist Rachel Kidman talking with WPR's Lee Rayburn. You can read more about Kidman's research. Find a link at wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, we meet another candidate seeking to become Milwaukee's next leader. What challenges do you want Milwaukee's new mayor to tackle head on? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking with candidates in the race to become Milwaukee's next mayor on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Seven candidates are on the ballot in the nonpartisan primary election set for Tuesday. Top two advanced to the spring election April 5th. Former Mayor Tom Barrett resigned in December to serve as U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg. What do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize? What are the city's biggest hurdles, its biggest opportunities? 800-642-1234. Bob Donovan is a former city elder, past candidate for Milwaukee mayor. Bob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, start with your top priorities, if you will, for the city. What are they?
Well, I think first and foremost, there are three immediate challenges that whoever Milwaukee's next mayor is going to have to tackle head on right from the start. Number one, to provide the appropriate level of leadership that, in my estimation, hasn't existed in Milwaukee for quite some time. Number two, the public safety crisis that we're dealing with, from reckless driving to record-breaking homicides 2 years in a row to, sadly, leading the nation in stolen vehicles. So we're dealing with this public safety crisis that is strangling the life out of Milwaukee. And then finally, the fiscal challenges. Most people aren't aware, but Milwaukee is actually teetering on the verge of insolvency. We desperately need a partnership with the state of Wisconsin to address these challenges and move this community forward. So I would say those are the three immediate challenges that need to be addressed right off the bat.
Well, let's start with number two, the public safety crisis that you referenced. How would your administration seek to reduce violence and reckless driving?
Well, I think we need to look at a couple things. First, I would argue you simply cannot expect order and stability on our streets and neighborhoods unless we have the appropriate level of manpower in the Milwaukee Police Department. They simply cannot keep up with the 911 calls, the calls for help. And of course, that's all reactive policing. We want a force that has the ability to proactively patrol our streets. I've always been a big believer in foot patrol and bicycle officers connecting with the people they're protecting and the people connecting with those officers, getting to know one another. There's no better way to improve police community relations than that kind of policing. So, yes, we definitely need to provide. We've cut the department's manpower by hundreds over the last few years. That needs to be turned around. Second of all,
I just want to pause right there, because the Milwaukee Police Department has had quite a bit of difficulty getting new recruits. How would you approach that issue of even getting enough candidates through the door and through police training to be able to be officers?
Well, certainly we have to, even if it takes going to other communities to recruit people, certainly that's been the case with a lot of departments across the country. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's not an issue, quite frankly, that many in Milwaukee are even talking about. But yes, are we getting the quality candidates that want to become officers? And I would argue this. In order to be a good police officer, one who is committed to the profession, it's a vocation. It's just not a job. It's just not a 9-to-5 job. It is a vocation. It's a calling. So, yes, we need to reach out. I would want to work. And I also think it's important that we have officers that reflect the people they're protecting. I would want to work closely with the League of Martin and other organizations, retired black police officers, perhaps, that could help in the recruiting process, Latinos as well. Work with those kinds of organizations to reach out into our schools, into our community groups, and make that connection. Oftentimes, a young person may not have a positive connection with a police officer. Let's face it, oftentimes they see a cop dealing in crisis situations, in very challenging, difficult, emotional situations. I would love to see, and we had a program here in Milwaukee, it needs to be brought back, called STOP, Students Talking It Over with Police. And I think it was an excellent program. It received national awards. We need to bring efforts like that back. Also, the PAL organization, the Police Athletic League, where police officers were involved in sports and mentoring of young people. There are a lot of things that can be done as long as the person in the mayor's office has the desire and the will to move forward and make it a priority.
Let's look at those fiscal challenges that you mentioned. And starting out with pandemic aid, because the city has roughly $200 million in unallocated federal funding for responding to the pandemic. How should this money be used?
Well, I think certainly I would want to see some of the funds go to our businesses. I think small businesses, I think over the last 2 years, they have really, many of whom have taken it on the chin with the lockdowns, with the mandates and so on. Some of them have lost their businesses. We need to be a community that helps our small businesses prosper. After all, small businesses are the backbone of any neighborhood. They're the lifeline. They keep a neighborhood strong. In some instances, they're like an institution, many that have been there for decades and so on. So it's important that I think a certain amount of that funds go to our businesses.
Well, let me reintroduce you here as we have conversations with all the candidates for Milwaukee mayor ahead of the February 15th primary. On the line is candidate on the ballot, former Milwaukee elder Bob Donovan. You can join in. What do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize? What are the city's biggest issues and how would you tackle them? 800-642-1234. Also, in the fiscal house, if you will, the city is facing more financial pressure next year when pension obligations become due. Would you, in light of the issue with pensions, would you support raising taxes or cutting city services in this type of budget crunch?
No, I wouldn't. I think the answer is not more taxes, most especially given the inflation that we're facing currently, the fiscal challenges that most families are facing. But as I said, this is going to have to require a partnership with the state. And I believe I'm the candidate who can get that done. I believe over the years I've developed good working relationships with our state legislators. And it's critical. Also, I might add, Wisconsin is looking at a significant budget surplus to the tune of almost $4 billion. I would hope that our representatives in Madison, including the governor, would recognize the importance of helping Milwaukee, because what happens in Milwaukee is spreading to our suburbs. It impacts the region, but it impacts the entire state as well. So everyone has a vested interest in a well-run, efficient, successful, prosperous city of Milwaukee. So that's why it's absolutely critical.
I'm going to jump in here and bring on Mo in Oconto. Mo, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I hear a lot of candidates running for mayor, not maybe for Milwaukee, but it seems like we got to be tough on crime and bring in more police. And I think really we need to bring in good economic opportunity, create a sense of community where people look at each other as friends and neighbors more than just put down an iron hammer and say, let's bring in more power like Putin.
Mo, thank you for the call. Bob Donovan, number one on your list was leadership, and I wonder if that bridges into what Mo is talking about here.
Well, without a doubt, and he raises a good point, certainly. Having said that, you're not going to be able to do anything positive in a neighborhood or in a community unless that community is first safe and stable. Once it's safe and stable, positive things can happen. Businesses will want to come in. Also, I would argue a major concern is our educational system. So those two major responsibilities of local government that, in my opinion, have been neglected over the last many years, and we're suffering the consequences. But without order and stability, you can't begin to revitalize neighborhoods. So that's number one. And absolutely, once that occurs, you can then bring in businesses, and so much can prosper. But you got to ask yourself, do you want to move into or open up a business in a neighborhood that is factually unsafe and perceived as unsafe?
And Bob, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us, former city elder. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.